This program is brought to you by the Kentucky Women Writers Conference on iTunes U at the University of Kentucky in Lexington. For more information on the conference and to access our complete audio archive, visit us online at kentuckywomenwriters.org.
Thank you. Is this on now? Okay, yeah. Thank you for that lovely introduction, Patrice. Thank you. It's really an honor to be here today in Kentucky. And I've met some really interesting, talented writers, some of who are sitting in the audience, and I'm smiling at them right now for my workshop. And I'd like to thank you again to Julie Wren and to Jan for driving me around wherever you are. Thank you. And to Patrice for taking me for that fish sandwich yesterday and driving me through on the golf cart through the Roots and Heritage Festival. It was a pleasure to get to know you, and thank you for your time and your generosity and for that bright, lovely little daughter of yours who is just the most charming little thing. When I was asked to give a lecture, I wasn't sure what I would say, what I would talk about. I really do my best communicating in my office, sitting behind my desk in front of my computer, and that's where I get most of my good ideas. But I thought it might be helpful today to share my journey as a professional writer, so that's what I'd like to talk about now. The question I'm asked most by readers is, where do I get my ideas, and what steps did I take to become a writer? How did I go from just dreaming about being a writer to actually getting published? How do I create my plots and my characters? And when I really look back at the things that I've done over the past few years, problem with notes in the wind, I realize that I've taken very definite and very concrete steps to get here. First, though, I'd like to share a little bit about myself. I graduated from Howard University and majored in philosophy, of all things, with a double minor in English and sociology. After graduation, I taught in a daycare center for about a year or so, and then went to graduate school at Bank Street in college in New York and majored, as Patrice mentioned, early childhood education. In my 20s and 30s, I was at home with my children, basically a homemaker. Never let anyone tell you that you can't learn things being at home with your kids. Every skill that I learned, particularly about managing time, which is crucial to being a writer and to being an editor, you really learn from juggling the various chores, personalities, and schedules of people under 18. It's really important. It was really important to my growth as a writer and I think as a person. When I was 35 and my kids were well into elementary school, I decided to go back to college and get a degree in journalism. I enjoyed early childhood, but frankly, being at home with two kids was kind of did it for me in terms of, and I really wanted to go in a different direction. So I borrowed some money and went to the Graduate School of Journalism at Columbia University. After I graduated, after about 10 months of looking for a job, I was 36. I was hired by Scholastic News, and I was probably the oldest assistant editor in the history of the magazine. Those jobs usually go to people in their 20s and 30s, but it was a first step. I left Scholastic, and after about 2 years, I moved to Essence Magazine as assistant editor. Again, the oldest assistant editor in the history of the magazine, because those two jobs also go to people in their early 30s. But as we all who are over 60, and I am over 60, as we all know, age gives us certain skills and certain strengths that younger people certainly still are learning to acquire. And it really paid off in that job because I was so much older, and after dealing with the kids and everything else, I was quickly promoted to associate editor and then senior editor and then finally executive editor, which is where I was for 7 years, until I finally left to write books. And leaving Essence was a very hard decision. I had a good job, a great job, a dream job. And I looked forward to going to work every day. It was just a pleasure. I loved my boss, Susan Taylor, who is just everything you can imagine in a boss. She was generous and kind and supportive. I loved my co-editors. I mean, in my first book, When Death Comes Stealing, all of their names are in my acknowledgments because they were all helpful in so many ways. But all my life I'd loved to write. And I had dreamed of becoming a writer. I'd attended writing workshops, which are very important, by the way, to those of you who want to learn how to write. I'd written short stories, but I hadn't had anything published. Yet I still had that dream, even at the ripe old age of 42. I couldn't let it go. I had to find a way to make it come true. During editorial meetings at Essence, we editors had to come up with ways to make an article exciting, something to put on the cover, called cover lines, that would enhance newsstand sales. And one sure way to enhance sales was to use numbers in the cover line. 7 moves that'll ruin your life. Things like 5 moves that'll please your man in bed. Sound familiar? And cover lines are how I came up with the title for this little talk today. 6 Steps to Getting Whatever You Want. It has a nice rhythm. 6 Steps to Getting Whatever You Want. And it all comes down to the same thing, same basic steps, no matter what you want. My goal was to become a published author. But I think these steps can be used for anything, from starting your own business to making your own jewelry to making a difference in your community. So I'd just like to share them with you now, starting with step number 1, which is commit yourself to your goal. I knew I wanted to write. I'd always loved to write. When I'd been a kid, I'd made up plays and for my dolls and my sister and my cousin. I wrote poetry when I could. I always was doing it, and I was always writing something. I joined the Harlem Writers Guild in Harlem, and I had more than my share of rejection letters. And I'm still getting them, by the way. I still remember the way, and many of you who are writers have probably shared this, remember the way my stomach would fall when that old, familiar, self-addressed envelope would find its way back to my mailbox after 6 or 7 months of circulating. And it would always say the same thing or say nothing, which was even worse, ends of the paper all bent. And it was always sad, and it was always depressing. And I would always say, should I bother doing this anymore? But I was determined to commit myself to this goal of writing a novel and getting it published somehow. I didn't know if I would be successful doing it, but I knew I had to try. I had no control over the success I would or wouldn't have. You never do. You don't know what's going to happen. You have no control over what is going to come your way. But I did have control over my time and how to use it. And so I made a commitment to the goal of writing. And I read as many books as I could on how to write. Every single book that's out there I had at one point or another. I really learned what it took to be, you know, the various skills. I recommended some to my workshop today. And I have many, many more. My library's filled with what to do this, how to do that, the 5 basic steps to writing. And this is what I really tried to do. I would try to start a novel or a short story, polish up old stories, search for possible markets. And the writer's market is also a very important tool as a writer. Subscribe to Publishers Weekly, Poets and Writers. There are lots of magazines, literary magazines, that are important for you to read if you're an aspiring writer. And I would send stories out, get them back. But I would continue to write anything that would keep me at my computer. Once when I asked a friend, a playwright, whose work I greatly admired, what made a person a writer? She simply said, well, you know what, honey, a writer writes. And that's the bottom line. A writer writes. And if you don't write, you're not a writer. It's funny, about a year ago, I had a hard time selling a book. Everything was closed. The market was really closed for me anyway. And I finally sold something. A little bit more about that later. And I said, am I really, you know, one day I said, you know, I hadn't written in months. And I realized, I can't call myself a writer anymore. I'm not writing. I'm just not writing. And that very day, I sat down at that computer and I started a new proposal. And I felt good about myself again and good about being a writer. And that's what it takes. You simply write. As simple as that. So I began to write. I wrote and I made myself write. And here comes the second step, which is always look at the lay of the land. See what's out there. Survey the marketplace. Realistically look at what you want to do. If you're selling jewelry, that means see what's selling. If you're selling a house, see what's selling and what price it's selling for. If you're baking pie, see what people are eating. The main thing is to see how the market is going. See what the trend is. See the lay of the land, how it's going to go. I decided my first book would be a young adult novel. At the time, a young adult novel seemed an easy thing to write. Actually, it's not. It's very hard. It seemed manageable. Fewer pages, I figured, a subject I could handle. I sure knew about teenagers at that point. So that was my feel. I didn't realize it then, but writing for children is very, very difficult. And that market is just as difficult to get into as is the one for adults, if not harder. But ignorance is bliss, and I went ahead with my goal. When I was in grad school, my master's thesis was on how to enhance African-American children's self-esteem through the use of ethnic literature, an academic, very academic sounding. I focused on the Reconstruction period, which was an amazingly interesting period for black people and a very empowering period. And I did extensive research, and I wrote a few sample chapters of what I felt a good historical novel would be for young adults to read. And so when I decided to try this young adult novel, I simply went back into my rewrote my sample chapters, took out all the academia, all the footnotes and everything, retyped it, and sent it to an editor at Dutton, which no longer exists, which tells you the state of publishing. Everything has changed. I think most of the houses, I don't know how many there were at one point, now it's like five, and they all own each other. And I sent it to the slush pile, which you can no longer do. You almost really need an agent now to send it to an editor. It's amazing how much it's changed. And at that point, the editor actually called me on the phone after about 6 weeks and said she loved the writing, but they were not doing history. They wanted something contemporary. You know, history is not selling. You just have to give it something hipper and smarter and younger and sharper. And she asked me, what do you have that's contemporary? What do you have that they're dealing with kids that's going on today? Do you have something? And I said, oh, yes, absolutely, I do. Complete lie. I had nothing. Absolutely nothing. And that's it. And that's the next step. When you see an opportunity, grab it. Don't wait around and say, well, you know, I could have said, well, give me a couple of weeks and I'll come up. No. She asked me, do you have something? Yeah, I got something. It's really good, too. But let me have a couple of weeks to polish it up, which is what I said. Nothing. Nothing at all. What do I do? But like I said, third step, when you see it, grab it. Because in the bottom line, a chance is a chance. A bird in the hand is always worth two in the bush, especially when it comes to books. So I told her I wanted to polish it up a bit, like I said, and I'd send her a proposal, which is three chapters and a synopsis. Nowadays, I think if you're a beginning writer, you really need to send them the whole book. That's been what most people are experiencing now. But then I was able to say a proposal, and she said, okay, I'll take a look at it. And then I realized after I told her that my proposal was basically being polished up that I had to actually write the darn book. At the time, my husband, who is a screenwriter, he's also a professor now, but he was at the time a working screenwriter, was working on a teleplay based on a book called Best Intentions. It was about a young boy who grew up in a very rough neighborhood in Harlem and was accepted into the ABC program, which was a program that grooms bright young kids and provides them with educations at very exclusive prep schools. And this kid, I think, was going to Exeter. And the summer of his junior year, he came home for the summer. And on a whim, completely on a whim, with his big brother, robbed a guy in the park. And the guy ended up being a cop and shot him to death. It was a terrible tragedy for that family. It was actually a movie of a week, too. I forget what they called it. It wasn't Best Intentions, but you see it every now and then. And I think Richard wrote the screenplay, actually, for it, too. And it was just the mother, her name was, I think, Veronica, it just broke your heart to see this kid. His name was Edward, I think, or Edmund, I think. Edmund Perry, that was his name. And no one ever recovered from that. But the good thing about writing is that you can change sorrow into joy. You can take tragedy and turn it into comedy. You can let the good guys win. You can make the world turn out right. And Richard's story gave me an idea for one of my own. And my YA was going to be about a kid from a rough neighborhood who goes to an exclusive prep school. But in my doll, everything was going to be different. I made the guy a girl who grew up in Newark instead of Harlem, who prevents a boy from Harlem, who attends the same exclusive prep school as she. And it's a school that, of course, there is no such school in existence, but I made it up with my fantasy of what an exclusive prep school would be. Anyway, the plot was that the young man ends up running away, just disappearing in the middle of the night, not telling anyone where he is or what he's looking for. And her name is Nia. She ends up searching for him. I had my idea, and all I had to do was get those first three chapters written so I could show it to the interested editor. And that is my fourth step, probably the most important one of all of the steps that I will share with you. And that is discipline. And that means discipline simply means doing it. Put on the pedal, I forget the word expression. Start it, write it, don't get up until it's done. And I think it's one of the things that stumps a lot of writers, stumps most beginning writers, particularly if you're, you know, not sure of your ideas, your characters. You ask, how do you find the time? How do you make yourself sit down, do what you have to do? How do you write or paint or bake or make jewelry? And it always comes down to simply doing it, simply sitting down, finding that time and discipline. And that's what I had to do. I had to do it because I'd made the commitment. But I was working on a very demanding job. I would leave my home at about 8 in the morning every day and would not return home until around 8 or sometimes 9 o'clock, 8 or 9, 7, usually around 8 o'clock, 7 or 8 at night. Although my oldest daughter had gone off to college, I still had a teenager at home, and actually had two teenagers because an actor friend of ours had left his kid to board with us while he went to California, which was kind of a drag, but he was a delightful kid. But now I had two, one I didn't know very well. And I knew that my husband also had left and gone to California for 6 months to work on a project. So I was kind of virtually a single mom for that period with these two teenagers at home. But I knew I had to finish this proposal. I didn't have a choice because this was my shot. And I think when you have kids, how many people are writers, first of all, in the audience? You all are, I guess. But how many are also parents or mothers dealing with kids? You know, yeah. Someone's chuckling over here. Well, you know, I'll tell you this. The most important thing you can have is a schedule. I mean, everyone has to abide by it. And in order for me to write at night, which was the only time I had to write, everything had to be done, cooking, laundry, cleaning, by 9 o'clock, so I could write from 10 o'clock to midnight. That was my writing time. The kids cooked a little bit. I mean, they could make little sandwiches and stuff like that. But mostly I used something that you probably all, if you're married, got wedding gifts, a crock pot. I don't know if everyone has a crock pot. Oh, it's amazing. Everything I could possibly do in a crock pot, I would do. I mean, spaghetti sauce, roasted chicken. Everyone tried roasted chicken and a really fall-off-the-bone chicken. I know one time I came home, my little count, who is my little, quote, boarder, temporary son, had eaten the whole darn chicken. I had no idea. He was sitting up. I had no idea that boys ate so much. I had two girls, and this kid just, I said, count, where's the chicken? And my daughter said, he ate it. He ate it all. So, but anyway, the crock pot more than once saved my life. And everyone did their own laundry, which was really important, because sometimes I think of it, you get in the habit of just throwing it in the washing machine and letting. If you want to clean underwear or clean clothes, you did it yourself. I wasn't doing a darn bit of laundry for anybody, even my own sometimes. I would forget. I cleaned house on Saturdays, but a spotless house was not a priority, and it still isn't. You've got to choose what you're going to do, and that's what you go with. And by 10 o'clock at night, every night, I had time to write. I would get in my PJs. I would have a little ritual. I'd come home from work, chat with the kid, chat with the kids, get in my PJs then, report to my desk as if I were reporting to a station or a boss, and with a cup of herbal tea, generally. I think I usually did Red Zinger, which is a nice herbal tea. It kind of gives you a zing, but it also is relaxing. And I made myself type at least 2 pages a night. And by the end of the week, I had 10 pages. In 4 weeks, I had 40. And even now, when I'm working, and I'm working on a book now, I have a certain quota of pages that I type. I think it's 4 to 5 now. And I make myself do it. I do not leave that typewriter until it is done. And even if it's just the top of the page, I might say, well, I'm going to do 5 pages. Even if it's 4 and there's one sentence on the 5th page, that's fine. I'm free. I can leave. I can go. I've done my quota. I think it's like, actually I do 4, I think, now. And it's amazing how quickly you can finish a chapter and you give yourself time to do other stuff and you don't force yourself to get into a snag because you write and write and write and then you edit after you finish the writing. That's one important thing in terms of, I find, in terms of, yeah, I'm a natural editor, so I would edit, you know, I used to edit, I don't anymore. But the important thing for me, I finish a chapter and then I go back and edit it. And then I put that particular cap on and that allows me just the free flowing of writing and that's essential. Anyway, in 6 weeks, I had about 50 pages of a novel I called Marcus Garvey Williams and the Endicott Blues. And it was enough to send to the editor who requested it. Thus comes the next step. Step number 5, expect setbacks and don't let them set you back. The editor wanted the entire book, which I didn't want to write, without a contract. I moped around for a couple of weeks and was discouraged and said, oh, what am I going to do? And then I met my agent. Actually, she came to my house. She was with a good friend of ours. She came to my house for dinner with her then boyfriend. And we hit it off right away, and she was just beginning as an agent. Now she's a very established agent. Her name is Faith Hampton Childs, and she was excited about, I think I may have been one of her first clients, actually. She's still my agent and a friend. And I mentioned her in all my books. You'll always see a mention to Faith. Anyway, Faith took my proposal, and she was able to sell it to Scholastic, my old house, my old boss, on the strength of that first 50 pages. And there is nothing like getting, as writers here who've published things, that first contract for your first book. It's exhilarating. You're overwhelmed with pride and excitement, and, oh, it's like a dream, finally fulfilled. But then, of course, there's also apprehension. And they've given you, I got an advance. And you don't want to have to give that advance back. That's a nightmare. You know, what do? You spend the advance. So I had to write the rest of the book, the next 150 pages. So I set my goal again. I said, instead of 2 pages, I'm going to write 4 pages a day. And that's what I did every night. And the same schedule, the same ritual, every single night doing it. Often I would take Sundays off. But certainly the rest of the week I would do it. And after I turned in my young adult novel, which was renamed Where Do I Go From Here, they thought the title was too long, which often they do feel things are too long or not right. I decided I wanted to try a book for adults. Yet then again, I looked back, took this first step, making that commitment to myself. Taking a look of the lay of the land was a good time to sell a book for adults. Terry McMillan, Walter Mosley, and Toni Morrison were all on the bestseller list. And editors had finally, at long last, discovered that black people actually did read. For the longest time, and that's the truth, really, for the longest time, they would say, well, you know, black people don't read. Editors would be, I have friends who are editors who would be sitting in editorial meetings, and they would actually say this. And the amazing thing of it was, when they finally made this discovery, every editor at Essence had a book contract. I mean, they were just beating the grass, looking for people, looking for editors and for writers, because they hadn't nurtured a generation of writers. And now they're saying, well, they have different restrictions now on black writers. They just focus on one thing. I think it's urban lit now is the only thing they're publishing. But anyway, I realized that this would be a good time for me to maybe come up with an idea for a mystery because I liked Walter Mosley's stuff, and I also liked Terry. And I knew there just weren't that many folks writing mysteries. There were two that I knew of who were writing mysteries with black characters. One was a marvelous writer, Eleanor Taylor Bland, who had a character named Marty McAllister. I don't know if you know mystery writers and readers, if you know. And the other was Barbara Neely, who I like. You know Barbara's lovely woman, and who's writing a character named Blanche White. And that was it. So I knew there was enough room for me. So I decided I would come up with a professional private investigator. I wanted to do a character who was, on the one hand, a professional at what she did and not just someone who was kind of doing it on the side. I also wanted to make her a single mom because, while at Essence, I just got so many letters from mothers who were struggling, and I knew from my own very, very brief 10 months as a, quote, single mom, because I really wasn't. I had much more support than many women have. But it's tough to manage everything. It's tough to put everything in its place and to make sure it all goes well. Particularly when it always just comes back to you. And I wanted to kind of pay my respects to the single mothers that I knew. Give them their props, as once. I don't think they use that expression anymore. But that's what I wanted to do. And it was important for me to create this character who was going to be a single mom and very professional, but not afraid to handle a gun. Tough, but not too tough. And I think they said, tough and tender, tough but tender. That was one of their taglines for the book. She's tough but tender, savvy and sweet, you know. But anyway, they have these cover lines for books, too. And I came up with Tamara. And also, I think it was just important for me. I wanted to put this particular vision on. I want to write about Newark, too, which is a tough town with a very interesting underside and kind of gets a really negative rap. People from Newark love Newark. Like, people, you love your hometown. Anyone from Newark here in the audience? No, I guess not. Sometimes people are, and they, oh, thank you for writing about Newark. And I wanted to write about Newark. And I think that I was talking today in one of my classes about, in like my workshop, about setting, the importance of setting, and a mystery setting becomes a character. And Newark in my book was another character, and really getting to know it. Now, my husband grew up in Newark, so he knew Newark, really knew it well. I didn't know it as well, didn't know it that well at all, but he really would tell me, well, this takes this, and this used to be here, and this. So I was able to give a sense of history to the novels, which was very important to me, to say it hasn't always been like this. It was a very grand city, very important city, and it's falling on, a little down on its luck, like so many American cities. And in other cities that I've read, and even sometime in other countries, people will identify with the city. In Birmingham, for example, in the UK, they would say, this is like Birmingham, and or other cities, Cleveland, Detroit. These are cities, American cities, that have had tough times, and this is what I was writing about, basically, by choosing Newark. Shortly after my fourth Tamara Hale mystery, I left my job at Essence to write full-time, and that was scary. How am I going to make a living? I'm going to sell anything else? But somehow I did. I managed to. And after about 10 years of that, of doing the mysteries, I decided I really wanted to go into a different direction because, you know, although I love writing the mysteries, it's always in one voice. It's always one point of view. And I wanted to experiment with different points of view and write about from a male point of view. So I wrote my first, I guess you would call it, like, would label it as woman's fiction. They actually called it chick lit, but of course it's more like hen lit in my case. I'm not exactly a chick, you know. So that's what they would advertise, chick lit, you know. And I wrote three chick lit, or I prefer to call it woman's fiction, you know, hen lit, you know. One was Ain't Nobody's Business was the first one. The second one was Always Treating My Fashion. And the third is actually They're Selling Play My Mother's Blues, which is my third and latest novel. And then I've written two mysteries since then. One is Dying in the Dark, and the last one is Of Blood and Sorrow, which I'm not sure what's happened. They didn't do a paperback. Depressing, but hopefully I think you can get it on Kindle. And anyway, recently I decided to go in a completely different direction, a different genre, go in a different way. And so now I am writing a paranormal romance, the only thing that's selling. Vampires, a big one. I'm not writing vampires. I'm writing demon lover. Why not? And it's due to St. Martin's in June, and will probably be published in 2012, which is, I guess, a year. Usually you turn the book in, and then there's about a year it takes it to get it together, and probably the spring of 2012 it's going to come out. And I decided, just because I wanted to go in a fresh, kind of a fresh start, to use a pen name for this one, because the Mysteries, my name was very closely identified with the Mysteries, and they really wanted to see that, well, if you want to have one audience here, let's go for a new audience. So my husband and I came up with the name of Savannah Wells, which I thought sounded pretty hip and pretty young and pretty. And they love the name, so it'll come out as Savannah Wells. Valerie was mostly writing as Savannah Wells, I guess. And I'm also updating if anyone's interested, go to my website, and I'm updating that now, and that will be what you can look for. I feel very blessed, first of all, that I'm able to make a living doing what I do. And I think that I, as a writer, really feel the responsibility to push myself, to always try to make each book better than the others, to always kind of go for my personal best with each book. And that brings me to the sixth step, and that is to keep learning and growing as a reader, and a writer, excuse me, to read as much as you can, to really learn as what you can from other writers. And to read, I mean, I always make it a habit to always buy the prize-winning books, the Booker Prize, or any one that's really been recognized as a really major book, and read it and see what I can learn. See how they do it. See how they handle the narrative. See how they handle dialogue. If you want dialogue, Elmore Leonard is always a great place to go for there. See, you know, Anita Bruckner, I think that's how I'm reading, A.S. Byatt, who I like very much, and read Toni Morrison, of course. You read books like these, like artists will go to a museum to see how they do it, how they handle point of view, all the things that are important to us to learn and to deliver as writers. That's what you do. And I think in terms of that's pretty much what I've been doing. It's a process. Writing is always a process. It's always a process of learning. It's always a process of pushing. It's always going for what you can. And I hope that you will do that as well. I just want to thank you for coming. And any questions that you have, please, I'd love to. I guess my moderator has gone. Jan, thank you. Yes, thank you. But that would be good. Thank you. Anything I'll answer. Anything.
What is your website?
Oh, ValerieWilsonWesley.com. I hope it's still up. Valerie, V-A-L-E-R-I-E, Wilson, W-I-L-S-O-N, Wesley, W-S-N-E-Y.com. Or else you can, even TamaraHale.com, I think, is still up too. www. Yes, it is. Yes, Julie. I'd love to. I read the newspaper. I see maybe something that's happened in the news. It's maybe as simple as just, again, observing. As you, when you do characters or setting, you observe, you listen, you keep your ears and eyes open. I know I came up with a plot of one of them, and it can come from anywhere, an idea for a plot, at least for me. I was, a couple of years ago, they got the idea for a book called Easier to Kill, one of my mysteries, was... I was in Whole Foods, of all places. Do you have a Whole Foods down here? Yeah. And one of my daughter's friends, a really, really smart kid, who, beautiful little girl, had a baby with her. And she had been headed for college, and she was, you know. And it seemed. And I said, well, hi, what are you doing? Whose baby? Oh, it's my baby, Mrs. Wesley. And I said, well, what about? She said, well, you know, everything. I just had a baby, and I'm just going to take care of this baby now. And that's all I'm going to do. And suddenly the idea for the plot came into my mind of what would happen to a young woman with so much promise, and what would happen to this baby, and how she dealt with this. And that was ultimately the underpinning of that particular crime. It's more things are happening, but I was able in the book to, it was the one push that made, what if, That's always the question you ask yourself. What if? What if? What if this? And that's how you get the plots. For me, that's how I get them. It's just imagining things. Anything can come up. Anything could kind of spur you to come up with something. And what, I guess, in that case, was the sorrow of this young woman and the fact that her life had suddenly changed so radically and that she was no longer the little young girl I knew, and how she would feel about this child ultimately. And she seemed, you know, she was very kind of angry now, and she never had been. So she was, and I renamed the character Mandy Magic, anyone who knows the book, and this is who she became. So that is one way. It can be a dozen ways, Julie, that I can think of a book. The latest one I did a proposal for, of my latest mystery, and there was a piece in the Times, the New York Times, about maybe 2 or 3 years ago, about the after effect of aftermath of rapes and how that'll happen and you never really recover from it. It was a beautifully written piece. It was on the on the back end of the magazine section, and I was so touched by this woman's experience. I just kind of tore it out. Didn't really look at it for months, years, and then I was fanning through I have an idea package, and I found it, and I said, this is what happened, this is the story. And so anywhere it can come from. Thank you. Yes, hi.
Hi, I'm Declan, and I'm a memoirist.
Oh, okay.
And yet I've been studying fiction techniques in order to create a book that's readable, and I'm wondering, as a mystery writer, I'm sure that you have some techniques for creating suspense. Mm-hmm. And keeping your readers hooked in and making something a page turner. Can you tell me what some of those techniques are?
Well, you always end the chapter with a hook, so they have to turn the page. So funny, in my workshop today, I was showing with my children's book, and I realized that without even realizing I was doing it, that I'd ended the little first chapter of the children's book, although it's not a mystery, with a hook. You know, what's going to happen next? You want the reader to want to know. So that's certainly one way. Suspense you can create. If you want to see how to write suspense, you know, again, look at some of the masters. For example, take Stephen King and read him through in a thing that's really scary, and then go back and see how he did it. Often it's just short sentences. Dump, 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 dump. So, and your heart is thumping with the reading. And then you try to do it like that. And I've done that. If I write, as a mystery writer, you've got to write violent scenes sometimes. But one of my books, it's a really brutal scene. And in fact, it's the one about the Mandy Magic scene, the one that's easy to kill. And it was, I think that's what sent me to write the woman's fiction. It was such a brutal scene. I said, I want to be away from these people for a while. But I had to write it. It was a killing, someone's throat getting cut. And so I had to describe it. And so I had to imagine it step by step by step by step by step, how it happened. Dun, dun, dun. And that's how you write it. It's vivid. The main thing is to be vivid in your language and to show and not to tell, but to show. And I think it's the same thing with writing memoir. You've got to remember what you're writing about and bring it to life and use all your senses in writing. As you've probably been told many times, that's an essential part of creating character and setting and all the things that make writing vibrant and real, is to bring it to life. Okay, I hope that's helpful. You're welcome. Yes?
I have two questions.
Yes?
The first was about reading.
Uh-huh.
What are you reading now?
Well, I'm reading a book called A Closed Eye, and it's by Anita Bruckner, I guess. It's an English writer, yeah. And I'm reading, I always read a couple books at the same time. Because when I sold my paranormal romance in my contract, they said, this was amazing, they would say this in a contract. This book is like Gargoyle. I don't know if anyone's heard of a book called Gargoyle. It was a bestseller, apparently.
I'm reading it.
Are you reading? What do you think about it? It's okay. Is it? Well, I'm reading it too, but I can't get into it. Because I said, my God, I better read this darn book. I'd never heard of it. And so it's okay. I'm about halfway through it. And it's okay. You know, And so it's, just okay. So, but I think since it was in the contract and they said my book was going to be like that, I better read it and see. So I'm reading that. And so those are the two that I'm reading now, just those two. I really want to get, I just ordered a Kindle, so I'm waiting to get Isabel Wilkerson's new book, the one that's caused so much, you know, the one about the Great Migration. It's gotten amazing reviews everywhere. It's nonfiction. And then there's a new book by A.S. Byatt that I want to get. So I'm waiting for my Kindle because I want to put it on my Kindle. But I hope the booksellers here aren't angry at me for mentioning that. But those are the two I brought with me. And also the New Yorker, I'm reading some of the fiction in that. Okay. Right. I know Nazira.
And it's tough to sort of like expand the literary canon when you're teaching in our classes.
Mm-hmm.
I always feel like we need to be reading contemporary writers and writers that are not on the, you know, traditional list.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering, maybe you have some advice on that.
Well, you know, I always, after I've left here today, I'll probably realize I've been reading more books than I just mentioned. I happen to travel with those. You know, I think that for students, I'm not sure how you would, because I read for my own needs. You know, like I'm reading this Gargoyle, I'm reading Rikna Bakushi, but the styling is by, because I have to learn from these writers, and this is why I'm reading them at this point. I don't like what this new, a lot of the urban lit. I think that's not very good for young, and that's a lot of what, particularly high school. So I know you're teaching college, but for high school students, a lot of teachers are pushing that, and I think it's not a good idea. I don't know. I also teach creative writing, my students really are into film more than anything else. That's it, because it's a very media visual generation, and some read, but usually it's very fast books. And they're just out of high school, and they're, you know, they're really not into literature as such. I wish I could offer more advice. I'm sure tonight at 2:00 in the morning I'll think of it and, oh, I should have said that, you know. Why didn't I mention such and such? But anyway, gee. Anyway, so if I think of something at 2:00 in the morning, I'll email Nazira and she can tell you. Other questions? Okay, yes, and then we'll go. Well, I think the writer's market is a good place to look. They have a listing of agents. Don't pay anyone to be your agent, because they're usually not, you know, the agents take off the top. I think it's 15%, 20%. I think my agent takes 15%. And after they sell the book, they take it. So if you come to an agent and says, well, give me $1,000 and I'll sell your book, you don't want to do that. Agents take it after the book is sold. And that's important to know. Okay. But Writer's Market is a good source, and they have agents who are, you know, reputable agents and who really have to have, you know, be known and be, I don't know if they're licensed or not, but I'm not sure what goes into that, but I knew that these are editors that are reputable, rather agents that are reputable, and that you can be sure you won't get ripped off. There was another question over there.
Yes, I was just wondering, do you have any advice for choosing a name for a character? I know oftentimes a character will just tell you their name. What do you do when you have the story and the character won't tell you?
Well, I just get a children's book, like the book of names, or go online and look for names. You know, I mean, when you have a child, you have a book of this name and that and what it means. That's what I'll do. Easy for me. Yeah, and just choose a name. Say it aloud. See how it sounds. But you're right. They will sometimes kind of, you know, tell you. Because I had started off this book I'm working on now, main character's name was Michaela. But then for some reason when I started writing, the name Jocelyn came off the and then Michaela became her little girl, named after her father, Mike. So it's odd how it happens. Sometimes they will. Tamara Hale, my sister and I actually sat around thinking of a name for this. We wanted something with a rhythm, and we wanted to name her Hale because of Hale House in New York. And we knew Clara Hale, and Tamara, it had a nice ring to it, and it sounded, we wanted, sometimes it's just the way it sounds, and I like the name, and I'm happy that I chose it. It's just playing around sometimes, and going through the book of names for me, or now I go online occasionally, and just go through the list for that's one way you can do it. Something will strike you, you know. I guess I can't use Savannah now because it's going to be the name I use on the book, and I'd always like that name for a character. But, okay. Other questions? Yes.
I don't know how in touch you still are with commercial magazines, or through
a
magazine?
Not much, but I
was wondering about advice for getting published in that market.
In essence, like,
or any magazine. I think it's just you basically, I would say, a query. You know, you send a query. It's been a while since I've done that. As an editor, let me put on my editor hat. Okay, a good query is you grab the editor right away. You send some clips if you have it. You let them know that you know what you're talking about. What I would look for, and you have just a very brief space of time. I mean, my assistant would bring me like a stack of queries. Okay, literally like this. And I would go through them like... First graph, and then when something would grab me, and I'd say, hey, and then you read. So you've got to make sure that when you're talking about it or you do that first graph, that it's really, same with a novel if you're selling it to an agent, it has to be good. I mean, you have to grab them in the first page or they're not going to read it, even an agent or anyone, because you just don't have that much time. As an editor, you have no time at all. And sometimes their assistants will go through it. So it has to be clear, it has to be absolutely perfectly worded. I mean, you don't want any sloppy queries. You don't want any misspellings, double space, good margins, clean paper, you know. Every now and then, I would get a piece that would not be up, you know, as good as it should be in terms of being, but the story was compelling enough for me to research it and go maybe call the writer and say, this is what I was with the magazine, and say, you know, let's talk, and can you send me something? Okay, can you send me some clips? Or which are simply things you've had published. Maybe try some of the, if to start off, maybe some of the, like at the, I think in Edit, I don't know if in Essence they still have the, I used to be, I forget the name of the back, I was kind of the, where there was a story about a personal story, I forget what we called it. But I know in the New York Times Magazine section, there's the back page is always the end page where you can send something, and that they take queries, I guess, or not queries, but often the piece, 800 words, I think it is. Try getting those, and once you get a clip, it's a really good, you know, you can go on from there, and you start local things, local stories, local, you know, local newspapers, small newspapers are good. Same with small publishers. At this point, I think I might go with a smaller publisher with my mystery if I don't sell it, because I like the treatment that you get from smaller publishers. Is that helpful? Good. Just try, you know, I would say get the writer's market, and they tell you a lot about queries, and also, yeah, and it's just read what they say in terms of sending stuff in, and in terms of what magazines. I know with my students, when I haven't taught journalism in a while, but when you just see what magazines are buying what, local magazines are good. Okay. Other questions? Back in time.
Do you have any more questions?
Oh, please. Thank you.
So it sounds like you and Faith have gotten to be very good friends over the years, and so I'm sort of imagining in my head that this is the reason that she's willing to work with you from genre to genre, because it seems like, you know, once you're a mystery writer, you're a mystery writer.
That's what happened with me and the publishers. I mean, everyone did something different. I started out at Penguin. I did like 5 books with Penguin Putnam for like Tamara Hale. And then I wanted to try a different genre. And they said, no, you're a mystery writer. So, yeah. So I switched publishers. And I went to HarperCollins. And they did 3 of the books of my... Then I wanted to try another mystery. No, you can't try another mystery. And I had another house for my children's books, Hyperion. So, and it's the bad... In some ways, it's, you know... I wish I'd used different names for each of the genres, which is what I should have done. But I didn't. So I'm trying that now with Savannah Wells. So I'll see. And then I'll write the mysteries under Valley Wilson Wesley and the children's books under Valley Wilson Wesley. But this particular genre I'm going to write under this name. They're funny like that in publishing. But she is my agent, and she, even with the children's books, and most people don't handle children's books. If they're doing adult, they don't do children. So, but Faith and I, but she's a friend. She's a friend, and she's has helped me through, you know, and she's been supportive all the way through for each of them, even when I wasn't. It took about a year and a half to sell this book, a year, and it sold quickly when I sold it. But the mysteries I had tried for a year, and I mean, it's a bet. I had lots of mysteries out. So we'll see what happens with the mysteries. Wish me luck. Because I love writing them, and I've actually, this new one is actually good. But I'm also thinking that if I don't sell it, I may sell it online, or I may do something in a different direction, because I think that publishing is changing to the point where everything is up for grabs. And the big houses have no idea what's going to happen. They really don't know. And digital, it's changed everything. So I'm really thinking that if I don't sell the mystery, I'll just go on and finish it and then either put it online or do something radically different with it and sell it like that. It should be a new adventure for me, frankly, and something that I would look forward to doing. So we'll see. No, there's never, you know, a door never closes without another one opening. And I think it's absolutely true. You have to look at it like that. This doesn't work. Let me try this. Just don't get discouraged. You know, there's always another way out. So, and that's been my experience anyway. Other questions? Yes.
So if you're
going to
change
genres,
you're
going to
use a different name.
Yeah, I am. Well, you don't have to, but I am. I didn't which I think is, if I had gone with a different, but I'd already used my real name. I didn't know what else to do, you know. But with this one, I said, I think they thought that the name was too closely associated with mysteries. So when I said, well, let's go with a different name, and they said, yeah, okay, well. And it's also, I think there was a certain ageism involved, too, because I think they see you as a certain age and say, well, you just write for this generation or that. So this will be a different step. I don't know whose picture they're going to put on the book. It's my daughter. Put a hat on. Big hat, you know. Well, I guess, I don't know what they're going to do. I suppose it'll be, yeah, silhouette. Who knows what they're going to, because it's all about marketing and publishing. It's all about, and it's so sad because you don't realize that at first. I mean, the first thing they think of, the worst thing was when it came to me with my book, Play My Mother's Blues. I'll tell you how they decided on the cover, which I hated at first, I said, oh, this cover is awful. And this is the one that they're selling here. And I said, I hate this cover. In fact, I had a friend of mine who's an artist was so appalled by the cover that she created a cover that she thought. And I told my editor I wanted to. And then I said, how did they get this cover? And she said, we took it to the bookstores, basically, said. We took it to Barnes & Noble, and they said it popped. And sure enough, I said, oh, well, I'm not going to fight, and then the book doesn't sell, and they blame me for changing the cover, so I'm just going to let them do what they're going to do. Sure enough, at my first reading, I asked one of the readers and the booksellers, and I said, well, what appeals to you about the book? She said, the cover pops. So I think they know what they're talking about, you know. But I hate to think that a Barnes & Noble would decide what's going to go on, what they're going to sell and what's not going to sell. But now they're closing, too. So, you know, what can you say? I mean, Barnes & Noble, who thought that they were the big bookstores? I mean, they put the little ones out of, you know, they really did. And now they're closing. It's like a completely different landscape. And the first thing, it took me months to get back. After I signed the contract, it took me months to get it, finally get the advance, such as it was, and like the consigned contract. And it was because we were fighting over electronic rights. My agent had who owns what, and we wanted to make sure that everything was clear. That was what held it up, is that the publishing house was changing all of their contracts about the rights. So you've got to really know what, you know. And that's what my agent went through, every single electronic right, to make sure they weren't getting more than they should get. Thank gosh, you know, thank God for Faith, because she's also a lawyer. So she was able to do that. I just would have signed the thing and sent it back. But she did. She said, well, this is what's taking the 6 months for, it wasn't six, but because they really, really had to go back and forth, and we want this right, we want that, we'll let this one go, this one we want, this one we want, this one we want. And, you know, so that's what's changed. The whole landscape has changed, and it really has changed, you know. I think, I don't know, better, worse, I'm not sure yet. I think it gives writers more freedom. It might, it could. I don't know. But then who handles the money in the advances? Did you have a question? Yeah.
Well, I wanted to thank you for sharing your story of how being older when you got to the point of publishing helped you, because, and I actually teared up when you were talking about your experience as a mom and everything, because I stay home with my 3-year-old at this time of my life.
Honey, a 3-year-old, I know I have a 3-year-old grandson, and he drives me ragged. So I don't, but of course I'm 62, I don't know how you don't look one.
I really love the experience, and I hold that out in my mind that I want to publish one day, but I'm not willing to compromise this time in my life either. Yeah. And I've always believed the things that you said about that I'm learning time management and I know how to allocate them. When I get my time, I'm going to know what to do. You know what I mean? I just want to tell you, I really appreciate that.
Well, thank you. I know exactly. It's awful when everyone else is doing things and you're the one who's home. God, I remember I would go to parties with my husband. Oh, it was like, talk about tearing up now. And my husband was at that time really, and still is a fine writer, and he'd written some really important films. One was Uptown Saturday Night and Let's Do It Again and Native Side, really. And I would go to these parties with him, Holly, you know, and the people were so mean to me. They would say, "What do you do?" And I say, "Well, I'm home with the children." What could I say? I didn't say anything. I just bowed my little head and pretended and muttered something. "What do you do? Do you paint? Do you write? Do you..." And I had children. I was home with my kids, you know. And so to tell you how crazy it was, when my first book came out and I was on a book tour in Hollywood, and I was in L.A., and one of my husband's friends came up and said, "What are you doing here?" I said, "Well, I wrote the book." What are you doing here?" I said, "This is my book. I'm Valley Wilson Wesley." So it was like he didn't get it for a minute. I remember awful, awful humiliations of being in people, writers coming over and being made to get the tea, that kind of stuff. "Could we have some more sugar, Valerie?" You know, it's just really mean. So people can be mean when they think you're not. Yeah, but. And so you just have to take it all down, make notes. That's what I would do. And talk about where you get your names. Take some of those names and write them. You know, that's what I'd do if I were you. Make a little list of names and use it later in the book. I've been known to do that. That's writer's revenge, you know. I would just try to do it. What you want to do is just think of yourself as a writer, you know, even though you're home with a three-year-old. And I know what three-year-old is. Like I said, my three-year-old grandson lives with us, and my daughter and my grandson. And I babysat him for a day before I came here. And I have to tell you, I have never been so tired in my life. I thought, they're going to have to haul me to Kentucky because I am just, I don't know what I was going to make it or not. But I think that what you can do is you can make yourself at some point during the day, hopefully when he's asleep, get him on a schedule. I don't know if he's on a schedule or not, but that's very important. If 9 o'clock, make sure you leave yourself some time during the day. Otherwise, you will be enveloped with him. So you have to really get him on it, so he's in bed at a certain time. At the end of the day, take that hour, half an hour, just to write a page or a half, something. And that would be one way to discipline yourself to do that. Okay, try that. I think that might work. Just make yourself write a little bit every day. Even if it's writing about him, that might be helpful too. See what happens, and then. But don't. But it's important to get in the habit of writing. That's to write every day if you can. Only a page, an hour, 45 minutes, and that's your time. And have a place to write. It's hard sometimes, I think, for women to feel that we deserve our own space. And I know I used to write at the kitchen table, but I would set it up so it was like a writing space. When my kids were in bed, I would set it up. I have my tea and my pencils, and my typewriter didn't have a computer then, and my paper, and I would set it up so it was my space, and that's yours, even if it's a small space. And then when it's time to use the kitchen table for breakfast, put it all away, but make sure it's in a special place so you recall yourself a writer. And that, I think, is often important for women to do. And it's hard. It is very hard with young children. I remember. And like I said, I was home for a very long time, to the point where my children said, "When are you going to work?" Like everybody else's mother. "What are you doing here? Why don't we have a babysitter?" So, you know, I mean, I like being home. I still enjoy, you know, working at home. But it's, you know, but it was for me a luxury in some ways. Like, I was lucky. Many women aren't able to, and it was okay. It was good. Other questions? Thank you all for your attention, and it was, like I said, a great pleasure being here in Kentucky, and thanks. Thank you to my ladies in my class, too, where you are.
again for thanking to Valerie Wilson Wesley. There are a couple more things that I had to say. I didn't know
what you were going to say, so I didn't want to step over those. But the community service that Valerie did yesterday, she went to the Roots and Heritage Festival, and she was on the children's stage with her children's book, with one of the Wilhelmina Rules books, and she had a great intimate conversation with some
so
6 and 7 year olds. It was really fun for them to sit around the stage and get to talk to her. And the conference, I want to thank Julie Wren and the organizers of the conference who provided free books for the children. So there were free copies of How to Face Up to the Class Bully there, and they had great conversations about that. And a little bit before that, I want to thank, she's not here, but want to say thank you to Mona Willis Wigginton, who led a children's book discussion at the Northside Library 2 weeks before to get the children prepared and in the mindset to come and meet the author and everything. So that was really good. And the Writers Conference provided free books there. So that's just some of the great work that goes along in the name of Sonia Sanchez, that they're getting reading and books into hands of young readers, and we have great authors like you. So thank you so much for that. Valerie, you were very generous with those children yesterday. You didn't just read. You know, you talked to them and asked them how they felt about bullies. It was great.
It was so much fun. And I was, you know, they all had had confrontations with bullies, which was interesting, and like everyone had something to share. And I enjoy children. I genuinely enjoy children. So that's one of the joys is for me of writing for children is I like going to the schools, you know, and the greatest thing is sometimes the children will make big books for me, and I get emails from children, and you know what, when's the next Wilhelmina coming out, you know, and of course I'm looking for a new publisher, you know, which is another thing, but it was a great pleasure for me. Thank you for inviting me and for sharing those beautiful children.
Yes, ma'am. And what's great about this conference is that it kind of feels like you're in New York when you're here in Lexington, because we have conferences, we're in all different locations, so you get to move all around the city and get to experience it, but it takes a team of people to get our writers around, so I want to thank you to Jan Oakes and Doretha Burton, who helped us out with that, who made sure that Ms. Wilson-Wesley got everywhere that she needed to be this weekend. We want to also thank the Carnegie Center. They are normally not open on Sundays, but they opened up for the conference. And this is a new venue for the Sonia series. We're normally at Transylvania University. We've switched venues there a couple times, but this place really feels right and fitting. Mm-hmm. It's a place that a lot of writers unveil new works, and always writing going on in the building. So I think this is a great, great space to host the Sonia Sanchez lecture. So thank you again.
Thank you.
And thank you all for attending. Have a great day.
This has been a presentation of the Kentucky Women Writers Conference and the University of Kentucky. Copyright 2010, all rights reserved.